Jackson, W266DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Christopher Cruz. Israel has decapitated one of the largest terrorist groups in the world, killing the longtime leader of Hezbollah in an air raid in Lebanon. CBS's Imtiaz Tayyab is in the capital, Beirut.
In a massive escalation, Israeli fighter jets dropped a series of bombs on Beirut's southern suburbs, triggering deafening explosions and sending huge plumes of crimson smoke in the skies above. On the ground, near total devastation, at least four buildings pulverized. Israel's military says its target was Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, and this morning confirmed he was killed.
The death toll from Hurricane Helene now stands at 45 in five states. Flooding and rescues continue. CBS's Jason Allen is in Steinhatchee, Florida.
In Tennessee, National Guard helicopters spent hours airlifting more than 50 people, including some patients, off the roof of a hospital where they had been trapped by floodwater.
Rescues have been made, attempts have been made. Some people are stranded on the roofs of their homes and places like that.
Intense flooding was strong enough to wash away cars in North Carolina.
Vice President Harris and former President Trump will be spending this weekend in battleground states looking for votes.
The latest CBS News election poll shows Harris is winning over women by 7%, while men favor Trump by 8%. Each candidate is concentrating their issues to win with one sex over the other. But scholar Richard Reeves at the Brookings Institution says there's a risk in doubling down.
That requires them to ignore or even at worst pathologize the other side.
But will men be the winning formula when women historically vote more often?
Their turnout rates will not be high enough to make a huge difference.
Brad Gibson for CBS News.
Hurricane Helene hasn't affected today's planned 1:17 p.m. Eastern Time launch of the SpaceX Dragon spacecraft to the International Space Station. NASA Commercial Crew Program Manager Steve Stitch
had to go back to the hangar for the hurricane. And got out there a little bit late. We are vertical at the pad.
The country's oldest living president ever turns 100 years old Tuesday. President Carter's grandson, Jason Carter, spoke with CBS's Mark Strassman.
The question that everyone wants to ask is, how is he doing?
He's very limited in what he can do. He can't talk on the phone. He's following the news. When we asked him, was he excited about his 100th birthday? He said, I'm excited about that, but I'm really excited to vote for Kamala Harris.
The jailed music mogul Sean Combs has been hit with another allegation of sexual assault. A woman has filed a lawsuit claiming she was repeatedly raped and drugged and became pregnant after one of her encounters with Combs. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Artificial intelligence is controversial, but Wisconsin Technical College students are learning with the help of AI. Educators say it will prepare them for the careers of the future. Mike Moan reports.
Layla Merrifield, president of the Wisconsin Technical Colleges system, says manufacturers are making it clear they want a workforce that has the know-how in working with and programming machinery fitted with AI. She says that's why the system is integrating it with coursework at regional campuses.
Here in Wisconsin, we really have a structural workforce shortage, and our demographics are telling us that that will continue. And what we're seeing, it's really upskilling the workforce.
Elected officials face pressure to adopt regulations that would ensure artificial intelligence is used safely. Merrifield says schools in Wisconsin prioritize teaching students how to use AI ethically and appropriately. An analysis from the Center for Security and Emerging Technology says community and technical colleges have the potential to grow and sustain the AI talent pool, but barriers like inconsistent government funding need to be addressed. Merrifield says Wisconsin's campuses are coming off modest general aid increases from the legislature. She says they'll be requesting more in the next budget cycle. They also have to balance tuition affordability.
We understand that our students often come from limited means. They have limited financial resources, and so we try to keep tuition as low as possible.
And whether it's AI curriculum or other courses, Merrifield suggests they need the right amount of support to stay nimble and retool programming based on workforce trends. Waukesha County Technical College is one of the schools offering a class where students learn about the foundations of AI. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Mostly sunny by this afternoon. It will be breezy. A high around 71. Northeast winds at 15 to 20, gusting to 30 miles per hour. For tonight, mostly cloudy. Lows around 64. Sunday, partly sunny and highs around 72.
Right now, it's 58.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, James Vanderloo, the head of OEC Group, an expert in transatlantic trade and tariffs, will get all wonky with me. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. This is the Shaw, WAUK. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review, and yes, my name is Jim Santel. I'm your host on these broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin. Delighted to have you with me this weekend for our weekend weekly review of all things related to law and government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America, and today beyond that as well. Lots and lots of things on our docket, on our aggressive but achievable syllabus this weekend. Again, honored to have you with me and my terrific producer, Max. We are in the studios of WAUK in downtown Waukesha, but broadcasting throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. You can be a part of our discussion. Call me at 844-967-2789. That number once again is 844-967-2789. Max always hastens to tell me that you can also drop a question, an inquiry, a comment, some perspective about the subject matter of our discussion into the Civic Media app. Be a part of our discussion this weekend. As always, delighted to have you be a part of our discussion as we talk about these major things in the area of law and government and the aspiration for justice. Occasionally, I remind all of us that the name of our show, Amicus Law Review, takes its name from the Latin. It means a friend, ami. It's an individual and organization that assists in understanding or appreciation, assessment of some relevant issues or questions that need to be resolved, presumably most often by a court, maybe some government entity, sometimes a judge, some group or person out there that needs to be engaged in decision-making of some importance. The notion of ami, both legally and outside of courts, is a friend who assists in that process, in some understanding, some appreciation, some assessment of those relevant issues. And that's what we pursue every weekend here on this broadcast. Some analysis, some deliberation, some consideration, and in many cases, some basic reporting that has not otherwise been a part of the national or even statewide review of things in this area. And so that is why we take our name, Ami Amicus, a law review from the Latin, from the law, but also embracing, of course, that notion of being a friend to people who should know, who should understand and need to know this information as a result of decision-making. Of course, the big decision-making event coming up November 5th of this year, we are electing a president and others involved in our federal, our state, our local government. Important to be informed not only on the issues, but also on the candidates who are out there. An awful lot of wonderful programming going on here on Civic Media, discussing those various issues that are important to an understanding of what we do in the polling places on November 5th. And yes, before that as well. Regardless of how you vote, regardless of what your particular political or partisan persuasion may be, important to be informed and important to mark that ballot of yours based upon information that is reliable and truthful and accurate and indeed conveys facts about things that we know. And so to that extent, we have an agenda, a syllabus this morning that provides some of that information. Two major sweeps, two major movements this morning. One, the first hour of our broadcast this weekend, talking necessarily about Donald Trump once again. Lots of things going on in that area. We'll talk about what we do know and don't know about this major submission by special counsel in the election interference case. That's the federal prosecution of him pending in Washington, D.C. Filed a 180-page brief, a memorandum, just this past week. Even though it's not a part of the public domain yet, probably will be sometime soon. And we are going to take some indications from that and talk about what that probably says and does not say. In New York, some significant developments as well. We don't know the results there either, but we know that in a New York appellate court just this past week, a lot of skepticism about that major hundreds of millions of dollars civil judgment entered by Judge Engoron a number of months ago, finding that Donald Trump had engaged in fraud in violation of the civil law in New York. We'll talk about what the appellate court judges thought about that case, at least from the bench. No decision yet on that, but from the bench, what is it that they said and didn't say? We're going to talk as well about an interesting recent announcement by the Department of Justice as a part of its apolitical, nonpartisan approach to all of this, indicating that the Department of Justice, through a grand jury process, has indicted some Iranian hackers into what? Into the campaign mechanisms and platforms and formats of the Trump campaign. We'll talk about what that means, not only for the Trump campaign, but also for foreign governments, which is another part of our representation and our focus this weekend. And then we're also going to add on to that a bit about Rudy Giuliani. One time an advisor, a close senior advisor of the former president, one time mayor of the city of New York, now disbarred in Washington, D.C., in addition to other venues around the country. We'll talk about all of those things in the package of Donald Trump matters. And then, of course, the other big news item of just this past week, that is the indictment, again, by a federal grand jury sitting in the Southern District of New York, that's basically Manhattan, that returned a multi-count indictment against the sitting mayor of New York. His name is Eric Adams. We'll talk about the prosecution, what that indictment says. It's a talking indictment. Lots and lots of interesting stories from that. We'll talk about one of them involving a building that is owned by and is being operated by the Turkish government, and that's the key to that. A lot of allegations to Eric Adams on the take, based upon fraud allegations and corruption allegations from the Turkish government and Turkish authorities in particular. We'll talk about deterrence in that connection, why it is it's important to deter individual representatives in elective politics like Eric Adams, and also what messages it sends overseas to these other countries who continue to be involved in our election process. We'll talk about that, not only in the context of the Eric Adams prosecution in Turkey, but also taking some inventory of other things that have been done in recent years and days by the Department of Justice to ensure that our elections and the processes by which we identify our elected officials are not corrupted by foreign officials, foreign actors, foreign players. Finally, we're going to talk about a couple of things here in the United States of America having to do with the election in November. One of them coming out of Arizona, returning to the voting polls, the lists of people who are entitled to vote in Arizona. Great numbers of people previously disenfranchised through what is principally a clerical error. The high court in Arizona recently returning them to voting status. And then in the opposite direction, this Georgia decision by the Georgia Voting Board, the election commission there, basically issuing decisions beyond its jurisdiction, including for the November 5th election, requiring in the state of Georgia hand counting of votes, in addition to the electronic processes that, of course, are part of virtually every state, virtually every district, every polling place in America. What does that mean? And why are people responding to what Georgia is doing there, plainly in anticipation of the November 5th election, and probably if this goes through, prompting not only delays, but huge confusion there in Georgia about who won and who did not. That's all hopefully going to be in our first hour, just a little bit beyond. And then in our second hour, we're turning to an equally important issue that we have from time to time touched on, and that is the issue of sexual assault and yes, indeed, allegations of rape. We spend a lot of time talking about a major case, not much covered here in the national media, the local media, involving a huge case involving a victim of rape in France, in the Paris area, and in particular, identifying who the multiple defendants, about 50 of them are, what happened there, what the allegations are. We get a chance also to talk a little bit about comparative justice. We'll make reference to the fact that in France, their system of pursuing these kinds of crimes, horrific rape over a period of many years, perpetrated, yes, that's right, in principal part by the spouse, the husband of the victim, involving himself and 50 others from all walks of life. We'll talk about what that means and also talk about the ways in which that trial, now underway, is presenting to French authorities, presenting to the French population, a newfound understanding of the horrors of this kind of sexual assault. We'll take some lessons not only from that, but also the strength, the courage, the amazing courage of the principal victim of this case. We'll talk about who that is and why it is she has become the focus of so much of the civil rights attention and animation there throughout the state of France, the country of France. We'll chat all about that, and then we will return necessarily to the United States of America, where we have, as you well know, our own iterations of that. Different cases, all of these defendants, obviously, in America, presumed innocent until proven guilty. One of them, Sean Combs, of course, prosecuted now by the federal government again for similar horrific sexual events and engagements there as well. Harvey Weinstein back in court as well, having been convicted previously, back in court. We'll talk about the status of cases against him, likewise involving not such just sexual harassment, but sexual assault and rape against women who over whom he has power and had power when he was in charge of professional matters involving the entertainment industry in America. Sean Combs, Harvey Weinstein, both of them a part of our focus this coming weekend as we talk about all of these things in the focus of law and government, the aspiration for justice, all of those things. Second hour in particular, grisly. It is going to be somewhat graphic, a bit of a heads up about that, but necessarily in that nature. Why? Because it's important that even as we understand what goes on, it is important not to sugarcoat or in some ways have our language, our written language, our oral language, the words that we use, gloss over the catastrophic nature of this kind of conduct. It is not about sex in the end, although we even talk about it that way. It is about power. And these are individuals, these are defendants brought into the halls of justice because they've abused that power, undertaken that power, and engaged in horrific victimization of women and others related to those victims, likewise on the receiving end of this terrible, terrible conduct, charged in America and charged in France as well. A universal approach to this, which says this is not tolerable, and deterrence once again, deterrence that says, if you do this again, we will stop you out there in the community, and for the particular defendants, stopping you and sending you to prison, sending you away so that you can never do this. That's the specific deterrence about which we have often spoken on this broadcast. All of that coming up in this first and second hour of our omnibus, our broad analysis this weekend here on Amicus, a law review.
The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
How serious is youth vaping? Irreversible lung damage serious? 1 in 10 kids vape serious? Which warrants a serious conversation from a serious parental figure, like yourself. Not the seriously know-it-all sports dad, or the seriously smart podcaster. It requires a serious conversation that is best had by you. No, seriously, the best person to talk to your child about vaping is you. To start the conversation, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
It is National Monte Cristo Day. It's kind of one of those sandwiches. It's like bell bottoms. You just haven't heard about it in like 40 years. But it got me thinking, what's a sandwich that's totally overrated? I'm going to go first. The Philly cheesesteak.
Really?
Yeah. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm spoiled. Because in Wisconsin, we have the brat packed with tons more taste than a Philly cheesesteak.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus Alaraview here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Thank you once again for joining me on this, our weekly weekend discussion, analysis, a review of the geography of many cases involving the rule of law in America and beyond as well this weekend, beginning with the continuing prosecution of former president and present presidential candidate Donald Trump. That prosecution not yet underway in terms of a trial, but nonetheless proceeding apace under the administration and the review of Tanya Chutkan. She is the federal district court judge who's presiding over this count case against Donald Trump. He is the singular defendant in that case, four counts altogether, others identified as unindicted co-conspirators in that action. The focus of those counts, as we have talked before, an attempt to overthrow the results of the election of 2020, to stop the counting, to undermine the counting, to affect the Electoral College process, both before and during and arguably even after January 6th. Jack Smith is the special counsel appointed by the attorney general to prosecute that case again in federal court, not a state court proceeding, in the wake of a grand jury superseding indictment, a new indictment of just a couple of weeks that responds in part to the Supreme Court's horrific decision on July 1 that found for the first time in our nation's history that presidents, our chief executive, have immunities for crimes that they may commit in office, a stunning thing even to say out loud in any broadcast, to say out loud in any public setting. But that's what our Supreme Court has told us about the immense powers of the executive branch and the president in particular. Jack Smith, responsible now in the wake of that Supreme Court decision for prosecuting this case. He has gotten a new indictment that cleans up, if you will, gets rid of a lot of the things that the Supreme Court said a president cannot be prosecuted for. And so we've got a new superseding indictment returned by a new grand jury. And that's the predicate for the actions going ahead. The judge having a hearing and permitting in a 4-page order following that hearing, Jack Smith to file what turned out to be a 180-page memorandum just this past week. Now, what do we know and what don't we know about that? Well, the important thing to start with is it's been filed under seal. That's a fancy way, that's a legal way of saying that we do not have access to it. There's an entry in the docket, which is the official accounting, if you will, of what's going on in the case. But Jack Smith has filed that under seal. But he has said along the way that he also anticipates filing a redacted version. It's probably in place right now. It may have even been filed along with the complete document itself. That redacted version would presumably address some things that can be in the public domain about which we can know. And one of the assignments, one of the important procedural assignments now before Tanya Chutkan, is whether or not that much more disclosing document can and should be released to the public. An awful lot of indication that will probably happen. She has been very clear on her view that she is going to treat this defendant, Donald Trump, just like any other defendant. She talked about that just this past week or so. The Jack Smith, the special counsel here, having filed under seal that legal brief that contains apparently some sensitive and previously some unseen evidence, thus the sealing on that, in this case charging President Donald Trump with plotting to overturn the 2020 election. The brief was submitted over the objections. Counsel for Donald Trump objecting to the government submitting anything. Number one, saying, Tanya Chutkan, you should wait until after the election to decide anything related to this. Stop even the filing of briefs. This, again, is not the trial. We are in a pretrial stage. Don't do anything, Tanya Chutkan. That's what the counsel for Donald Trump is saying. And she, of course, rejects that, again, repeatedly saying, It's interesting that he is running for the presidency. That does not affect his status in this court. And so she solicits from, and she gets from Jack Smith just this past week, this magnum opus. We do not know the exact content of it, but we do know it's 180 pages. It plainly is an exposition of this. It's plain exposition of how it is that Jack Smith is going to be able to try this case in front of her to a jury convened in that federal courthouse. And that trial is going to be consistent, according to what Jack Smith is saying in that brief, with everything the Supreme Court said, including immunities, including all those restrictions that we have talked about on evidentiary presentations. Jack Smith and his folks have been working hard, and they put together a document that plainly outlines for Tanya Chutkan the notion that not only do not have to dismiss this case, but indeed, now that the indictment itself has been changed, consistent with what the Supreme Court has said, now that we've done that, he says, nothing about going ahead with this case is compelled by that Supreme Court decision. So go ahead, schedule this on for trial. Here is the basis for doing it. Here's the outline, the roadmap, Tanya Chutkan. That's what he's saying in this 180-page document. Much of it may well be documents. Interesting that they're documents, too. Maybe a lot of that are witness testimonial pieces, maybe some transcripts, maybe some other things related to documents. Recall well that there's this Fisher case that requires now, according to the Supreme Court, that prosecutions for the January 6th events be premised upon documents and papers and written materials and not simply attempts to undermine or overthrow an official proceeding. Jack Smith has a theory for that, and presumably some of those documents appended to his major memorandum describe exactly what those documents are. Maybe even notes. They could be emails. It could be all kinds of things. But they're a major portion of what Jack Smith filed this past week. In addition, once again, of providing to all of the parties, Donald Trump has the complete document. His counsel has the complete document. Plainly, Tanya Chutkan and her staff have the complete document. They are looking at that right now. And yes, indeed, as a part of our process, Donald Trump also has the capacity to respond to that, and explain from Donald Trump's perspective why Jack Smith is wrong and why it is that none of this should go ahead, why the Supreme Court case prevents the trial from going ahead. That's a part of our process, too. And that is the reason why in her decision permitting Jack Smith not only to go ahead with this, but also to file this oversized brief. The normal is 45 pages. This is 180 whopping pages. She also provided a civics lesson to America. She said, you know what? There is nothing about this process that is atypical or unknown. Every time we have a dispute, what happens? We take oral argument. We take written argument. And there is nothing about the defense posture, the defense position. And they have said on the record that this is unfair, that the government goes ahead and provides information about what the trial will be all about. That's not right, they say. That's unjust. That's unconstitutional. Tanya Chutkan shuts them down and provides this civic lesson to them, although they don't need to hear it. They know better than what they're writing on behalf of Donald Trump. But also to America, explain that there is nothing about this process at all, including the submission of this brief, which we will probably see in major, if not complete part, sometime in the next several weeks, and we'll talk about it here on this broadcast, of course. Nothing about this process that is irregular. In fact, just the opposite, is a part of ensuring that our adversarial system is promoted by people who have a full and complete opportunity to explain to the judge what their position is. And as she said in her 4-page order, directing that all this happened, I will take all of this under advisement. I will take under consideration all the things that all the parties say, and that's my job. As the judge in the end, I'll be the one who decides what happens in this trial. I may, in fact, pick and choose what Jack Smith says. I may pick and choose from things that the defense says. Everybody gets a chance to be heard. To the extent that there is this notion out there that somehow this process is illegal, just the opposite is what happens every single day, every single week in the federal and state courts of America. When we come back, more of Rule of Law in America here on Amicus. A Law Review.
You're listening to the Shaw WAUK, Waukesha's home for Up North News Radio.
CBS News brief, Hezbollah says its longtime leader, Nassan Hezrallah, has died in an Israeli airstrike in Beirut. Israeli military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari.
The leader of an evil terrorist organization, the senior terrorists eliminated with him, and the central headquarters were a legitimate military target under international law.
The death toll from Hurricane Helene has now reached 45. In Crawfordsville, Florida, Katie White's home was split in half when a tree in her backyard fell on it.
I've always thought that I would never be in this position before, but never say never, because it can always happen to you. Because it happened to us.
Former President Trump is pushing back on Vice President Harris's accusation that he killed a bipartisan immigration bill.
Let me tell you, number one, I didn't stop it. The senator stopped it. But that's the worst bill ever drawn. It's a waste of paper, and she doesn't need a bill.
CBS News Brief.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Bucky heads west. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with sports, filling in for Mike Clemens. The Wisconsin Badgers take on USC today as UW tries to rebound from a loss to Alabama 2 weeks ago. Head coach Luke Fickell said he expects to start making big plays the rest of the season.
That's the thing that I think gets lost in the whole grand scheme of things, right? I mean, you know, that it's some special play that you call. No, it's called execution.
Kickoff today is at 2:30 p.m. You can stream the game on the free Civic Media app on WRJN, WRCE, WFHR, or WLAK, or listen on any of those stations live today. The Brewers, who are locked into the NL's third seed, defeated a potential playoff opponent, the New York Mets, 8-4 on Friday. The playoffs begin Tuesday for the Brewers in the wild card round. The Green Bay Packers play tomorrow against the Minnesota Vikings. Starting quarterback Jordan Love is listed as questionable for the game. He's missed two games with an MCL sprain. Kickoff is at noon on Sunday. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cusca with Civic Media Sports.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Mostly sunny by this afternoon. It will be breezy, a high around 71. Northeast winds at 15 to 20, gusting to 30 miles per hour. For tonight, mostly cloudy, lows around 64. Sunday, partly sunny and highs around 72.
Right now, it's 58.
The bakers of Country Hearth and Village Hearth Breads are proud to support local education with Loaves for Learning, the program that makes it easy to earn money for your school. Enjoy Country Hearth and Village Hearth all-natural breads, buns, bagels, and more, then save the UPC from the package for your school to collect and redeem. Each is worth 5 cents and can be used for books, computers, sports, music, whatever your school needs, up to $10,000 a year. Learn more at loavesforlearning.com. Country Hearth and Village Hearth Breads, baking our best for you.
The spotlight will focus on Governor Tim Walz and Senator J.D. Vance Tuesday night, October 1st. Listen here as the vice presidential candidates debate issues important to you.
Go to the polls as a parent. You should have more power.
A belief that one person can make a difference.
Wisconsin Decides 2024. Special coverage starts at 7:45 p.m. Then listen to the CBS Vice Presidential Debate live at 8, Tuesday, October 1st, here on your local Civic Media radio station.
Make a difference in your community today. Find the perfect volunteering opportunity for you at volunteerwisconsin.org or by getting in touch with your local United Way or Volunteer Center. There are so many ways to get involved and make an impact. Paid for by United Way of Wisconsin.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on The Shaw. 101.1 FM and 540 AM WAUK. And on the Civic Media app.
Max Inc. on Civic Media, live in the lair with Kaylin Cole.
Have you ever walked away from a karaoke performance thinking, yeah, that was a lot better than the original person?
Oh my gosh, I don't know if I should admit that or not.
I think you should. Because now we know there's a song.
Jimmy's tugging on it now.
I know. Oh, you're going to get me in trouble, Jimmy.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at maxincradio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, very excited to have Lee McGowan, the politics girl, is going to join us as we break down the upcoming 2024 presidential election. Don't miss it.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is Amicus, a law review. This is our weekly weekend review of all things law-related. It continues now with more news coming out of an appellate court having to do with a previously imposed judgment against Donald Trump. You will recall well, lots of this in the news, lots of it discussed on this broadcast. The last year, yes, it was last year, that trial judge Arthur Engoron, he is a state court judge. He is also in Manhattan in a civil case brought by the attorney general. Her name is Letitia James. You recall that well as well, that he had concluded that Donald Trump is responsible for civil fraud in violation of New York law, concluding that Donald Trump had lied about his wealth to secure favorable loan terms and other financial benefits, all that presented by Letitia James in that civil case in front of Judge Engoron last year. The judge imposed the judgment, of course, against the former president in early part of this year, coming up on about a year or so ago in February, after a lengthy bench trial or so. The solicitor general in this case presented, of course, oral argument in support of that argument. Appropriately, as we discussed already this morning in this process, the defense also gets an opportunity to be heard by the appeals court. And how did this get to the appeals court there in New York to begin with? Well, the answer is, of course, it's an unfavorable ruling against Donald Trump. And as a result of that, he has a right. He has an absolute right, a procedural right to appeal that judgment, to basically say the lower court was wrong in doing this. The court erred. That's exactly what he's saying to the appellate court, the next court above the trial court judge, Judge Engoron, and identifying along the way the reasons why Judge Engoron was wrong. And it is in that setting the memorandums are being filed, the positions are being articulated in favor of, in opposition to the judgment entered against Donald Trump. That's what's going on at the appeals court level right now in New York. And just this past week, that appeals court deciding to and entertaining what's called oral argument. Again, the parties coming in based upon the things they have written, the identification of the big issues on appeal. They come in and they talk to the judges, the justices in this case, as New York calls them. The justices then have an opportunity to pepper them with questions about the legitimacy of their various positions, suggesting along the way that one side or the other, often both, are wrong about certain things, testing the validity, the veracity, the strength of the arguments being presented by the parties. And indeed, that's just exactly what happened. The Deputy Solicitor General, on behalf of the state of New York and Letitia James, the AG's office, had barely begun to address the court in that oral argument before one of the judges, his name is David Friedman, interrupted her to cast doubt on the lawsuit. And that's the big takeaway from this oral argument, that many of the justices, the judges there on this panel, seem very skeptical about the content, the breadth, the scope, the effect of what the trial court judge did. Other members of the panel also inquired about possible mission creep by the attorney general's office. They questioned about the guardrails that might have otherwise ensured that Letitia James did not overstep her bounds by second guessing the net worth estimates that Donald Trump had provided to these lenders during the course of the trial. Justice Friedman, David Friedman, who was perhaps the most skeptical of all of them, asked the Solicitor General, again representing the state, to identify any other case in which the Attorney General's office had sued to upset a private business transaction that was between equally sophisticated partners. That's what he said. That was his question to counsel for the government. Before she could respond, the court's presiding justice, her name is Diane Renwick, who generally seemed supportive of the case, asked her own question. She said, and little to no impact on the public marketplace. What is the impact of this case for our understanding, they were saying. The attorney, again, for the government replied. She said there absolutely was a public impact, all a part of the trial presentation, and that derived from the misconduct of Donald Trump. She said that Donald Trump had hidden certain risks, which had this ripple effect on how his lenders dealt with other clients. That also a part of the compelling presentation in the evidence of that case. While the statute that the attorney general's office used in the case did not require, did not mandate that his lenders have been harmed, there was no proof of harm necessary. Counsel for this state said the statute was intended to protect honest business people, and in fact, that the compelling nature of that evidence supports the appellate court affirming what the lower court did. The judgment, of course, that was entered by Judge Engoron hinged on this notion that the former president, Donald Trump, and others involved in this scheme, if you will, had manipulated some figures to inflate the value of his properties and to misrepresent to lending institutions, to banks, to officials, his actual net worth. And then he used those phony numbers, those fake numbers, to obtain lower interest rates from Deutsche Bank and other lenders. Again, lots of that being a part of our discussion in the past. In this very sweeping ruling, Judge Engeron had found that indeed there were conduct, there were pieces of conduct, actions that partake exactly of that kind of behavior, ordered him to pay a penalty with interest, which could reach about $500 million or more. Also describing for the public and for the parties to that case, the nature in this omnibus decision that he had authored, the reasons why he did what he did. Now, in arguing that the judgment that Judge Engeron had returned here, Letitia James' office also said that Donald Trump's appeal lacked merit. And the defendants here, including Donald Trump, tellingly ignore almost all of those deceptions in their appellate presentations. In other words, justices, you're not hearing everything that happened below. It's in our brief, she says. It's well exposed in the record, which the judges have access to, but you're not hearing it today. Now, in fairness, the questioning by all the judges about this case on both sides was vigorous. Justice Friedman asked at one point whether the AG's office had conceded that Trump received a lower interest rate than he might otherwise have received. And the counsel for the attorney general said, absolutely not, Your Honor. Nope. Had sufficient assets in this situation to receive a preferential rate. And the counsel for the attorney general said, no, none of that is true. The evidence is to the contrary, Judge, she said. And he went on to say, sorry, but what's being described sounds an awful lot like a potential commercial dispute between private actors. And others also weighed in. He also went on to say that this hardly seems like it justifies bringing an action to protect Deutsche Bank against President Trump. You've got really two sophisticated parties in which no one lost any money. Another justice whose name is Higgett asked if what could be done to ensure that the attorney general is acting within authority. How do we draw the line, he said, or at least put up some guardrails to know that when the AG is operating well within her admittedly broad sphere? The attorney general, again, counsel said that the attorney general is permitted to enforce the law of the state of New York, and indeed she is, to act whenever any person engages in fraud or illegality. The defendant's misconduct, the misstatements, she said, and omissions were about objective facts. She said there's a large number of reasons that justified this case being brought within the authority of the attorney general. And beyond that, a huge amount of fraud, all of that being argued. And of course, counsel for Donald Trump, likewise being questioned by the attorneys, the justices there as well about what happened, what did not happen. They also vigorously asking questions about the defense position in all this. In the end, this is a part of the process once again. The yin and yang of argument, the adversarial procedure now in the appeals court. The appeals court presumably at some point in the near future, maybe weeks, maybe months, but probably weeks, will issue its order. It could be doing a number of things, could affirm completely just Judge Engeron's decision, could find that it's excessive in its amount and chop it down a bit, could find that it's completely wrong, could do other things to address what they see as problems in his analysis. And then, of course, the parties have an opportunity either to go back to Justice Engeron and have those things remedied, or depending upon how Letitia James feels, how the defense feels, depending upon what happens in the disposition of this case by the appeals court, they could appeal then to the New York Supreme Court. The New York Supreme Court could then review this as well and do the same kind of thing, briefs and motions and memorandums. Attorneys like to write a lot of things and they like to be heard, plainly. And this would happen again. So you get at least two levels of appeal. Question whether or not the United States Supreme Court, from the highest court in the land, in New York, that is, from that highest court in New York, would take it to the highest court in the land, would accept that case and have United States Supreme Court review of this case. We don't know that, but presumably there might be a petition down the road. This will be a long time in process, and we will continue, of course, to monitor all of that as this appeal of that $450 million judgment against Donald Trump for the fraud that he had committed against the people and against the laws of the state of New York, subject to a lot of skepticism just this past week. by the appeals court justices who have the responsibility to determine what happened below. They've got the record to analyze that and figure out whether or not something has to be done to remedy a bad thing that happened, an error made by the lower court, or whether this can be affirmed. And in that instance, of course, producing even more appeals down the road. Along the way, in the category of Donald Trump, we also know that just this past week in Washington, D.C., not in New York, Rudy Giuliani, the one-time mayor of the city of New York, we'll get to Eric Adams in a bit, the mayor of the city of New York and longtime senior advisor to the president, Donald Trump, disbarred in Washington, D.C. after many other disbarments around the country. Rudy Giuliani officially disbarred in Washington, D.C., culminating a stunning fall from grace since the time that he was a former mayor. He was also the U.S. attorney, the United States attorney for the Southern District of New York. No small assignment either. A new order filed by the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. The court notes that Rudy Giuliani is hereby disbarred from the practice of law. Comes after the court reviewed the allegations that Rudy Giuliani and others, but in particular him, spread, yes, that's right, false information regarding the 2020 election, aided Donald Trump in that omnibus misinformation campaign. The order online, in re Rudy Giuliani, and all of that, again, a part of the record. Giuliani, of course, also under indictment in Arizona and Georgia. We're going to talk about those two jurisdictions and things that happened with respect to voting in those two cases. Also, conduct of his in those cases following the November 2020 election, trying to get the legislators there, the people there, the authorities there to buy into this completely false notion, fabricated, made up, which he has all but conceded now in other venues, in other circumstances. None of this real. Well, if you do that and you make those representations again in official capacities, in legislative capacities, to judges around the country, we will find you responsible for that conduct. And yes, indeed, you can get disbarred. Rudy Giuliani, a massive fall from grace just this past week. He once again still faces criminal charges in those other jurisdictions. And speaking of criminal charges, something else that the U.S. Department of Justice has done just this past week in connection with the Donald Trump current campaign. And it underscores once again this notion that the Department of Justice, as it pursues all of these kinds of things, prosecutions, investigations, does not in a proper Department of Justice question whether the Bill Barr administration was that kind of disinterested, apolitical, nonpartisan Department of Justice. But a Department of Justice does have as its core commission the responsibility to do what is right, to follow the law, to follow the rule of law and justice, and promote the administration of justice in a way that's fair and decent for everyone. And so in that connection, just this past week, the Attorney General announcing that their Iranians now are charged with violations of federal law for doing what? For hacking Donald Trump's campaign. The Donald Trump's campaign and the platforms and the information out there online hacked by Iranians. And what does the Department of Justice do in an apolitical, nonpartisan way? It charges those people with trying to compromise the Donald Trump campaign. Federal grand jury in Washington, D.C., indicting three members of a cyber espionage unit associated with Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. A wide-ranging attack they had mounted against the Trump campaign, targeting politicians and officials, journalists, that again led to this latest event involving the hacking of the Trump campaign. The Iranians, according to the charges here, had unleashed a barrage of emails and all of that as a part of trying to undermine the Trump campaign itself. And all of that, a part of the assignment given by the people of America to the Department of Justice, a part of the Iran's continuing effort to stoke discord, erode confidence in the electoral process, unlawfully acquire information related to former and current U.S. officials, including Donald Trump. As we continue more about that story and others related to the pursuit of justice in America, including in Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
The Shaw, WAUK.
I don't know about other states, but in Wisconsin, we help our neighbors and love our communities. But California mega millionaire Eric Hovde doesn't seem to get that. Maybe that's why he questioned whether children should be able to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26. And whether people in nursing homes should be able to vote. Hovde called for raising the retirement age for hardworking Wisconsinites and making obese people pay more for health care. And a Hovde company even spent decades trying to demolish the building housing Madison's oldest family-owned bar, something they finally did this year, shuttering a treasured neighborhood institution for good. That is not how we do things in Wisconsin. And that is why we can't let California mega millionaire Eric Hovde represent us. Paid for by a Better Wisconsin Together Action. ABWT-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Tom Allball Show.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour and next hour as well on this weekend broadcast of Civic Media, talking about the impartial, apolitical way in which the Department of Justice operates, announcing just this past week the indictments against Iranian actors, hostile international actors, including people from Iran, and also, yes, indeed, Russia and China, using some cyber attacks in the hopes of disrupting the U.S. election, focusing in particular upon the Trump campaign, but others as well, intimidating domestic dissidents abroad as well. What's this all about? Well, the hackers, again, charged by the grand jury, finding that there is probable cause to believe that there has been a violation of federal law, all living in Iran right now, not likely ever to face justice, of course, in America, unless they are foolish enough to get on a plane and show up at JFK Airport in New York or some other international airport. They have been charged with wire fraud and identity fraud and providing material support to a terrorist organization and a variety of cybercrime offenses. From 2020 to May of 2024, all three of these defendants, they're all apparently experienced computer experts, targeted dozens of current and former officials at the White House, the National Security Council, the Defense Department, and other agencies, apparently without success, according to this 37-page broad indictment. Also tried to compromise the account of at least two journalists, as well as members of some international non-governmental organizations, some foreign intelligence agencies, some human rights groups, some officials with Afghanistan's government and the United Nations as well, in addition to the Trump campaign. All of that announced this past week. Again, advising America through the official announcements of this by the Attorney General, by the Department of Justice, that the department is going to counter and disrupt the efforts of Iran as well as Russia and China to exploit the country's democratic freedoms. All of that coming from Attorney General Merrick Garland just this past week. The American people, not a foreign power, will decide the outcome of our election. We know that Merrick Garland has also joined in recent weeks with the State Department with respect to the 2024 election, not only in indicting other people, other Russians, but also doing all sorts of things to seize assets, to impose additional penalties for attempts going on right now to try to influence the 2024 election. The Department of Justice plainly no longer going to be caught flat-footed as it was way back in 2016, maybe less so in 2020, but this time being out front and charging people, including Iranians, who go after the Trump campaign and other institutions who go after those mechanisms for ensuring a fair and decent election here, try to compromise all of that. The Department of Justice saying we are going to charge these cases, also sending a huge message to those individuals, even those government actors over there, those government states in foreign lands that might try to do this. The message is, we know about you. We're investigating you. We see you. We have found what you have done. And yes, indeed, it may be that you're never going to face justice here in the courts of America, but you're charged. And those charges, by the way, remain indefinitely on the books until such time as ever as they are dismissed or they are adjudicated by a federal court here in the United States of America. Big deal having to do with what the Department of Justice is doing right now with respect to the Trump Trump campaign as well, to protect the legitimacy of that and many other things. The connection, obviously, to foreign countries, in particular Turkey, cannot be overstated. Arguably, the biggest news item of this past week is the indictment of Eric Adams. He is the mayor of the city of New York. The first time in contemporary history when the mayor, a sitting mayor, an incumbent mayor of the city of New York, is indicted by, again, a federal grand jury. This is not, and we'll get to this, this is not the president of the United States of America. It's not members of Congress. It's not even the local officials there in New York. It is not a part of an executive branch initiative. This is once again a federal grand jury sitting in the Southern District of New York and finding by probable cause that there's reason to believe that the mayor of New York has committed federal crimes. And in the wake of that, of course, it is federal prosecutors who are responsible for prosecuting now this major case, returning this major indictment against Eric Adams, New York City mayor. The indictment brought by the United States attorney, prosecuted by the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. That's basically Manhattan. It was unsealed on Thursday of this past week. Follows what appears to be a multi-year investigation, focusing variously on whether or not Eric Adams conspired. Yes, that's right. With the Turkish government. Here we go again. An overseas government to receive illegal foreign campaign contributions. And whether he took official actions on its behalf, basically almost becoming an agent of Turkey. Now, I hasten to add that there's no allegation here of what we've often talked about, no FARA violation, Foreign Agents Registration Act violation, but basically corruption when it comes to taking monies from, bribes from the Turkish government, Turkish representatives, and getting favors for that. We'll talk about some of those. As he ran for mayor in 2021, prosecutors are saying through this indictment, Adams sought illegal foreign contributions and other important things of value, again, as a part of his campaign. Benefactors then sought to cash in on those investments. That's classic corruption, right? That's classic graft and fraud. Thursday morning, when just before this indictment was announced, significantly, FBI agents, crack of dawn, descend upon Gracie Mansion. You all know that that's where the mayor of the city of New York resides. That's his official capacity. The warrant, again, justified not by the president, not by the governor of the state of New York, not by anyone other than a federal magistrate, a federal judge looking at the evidence and saying, yes, indeed, I believe there is evidence of a crime in that location. The warrant sought the mayor's electronic devices and authorized those agents this past Thursday morning to search the house for them, but nothing else. Nothing else can you take away from that. That a part of the authorization given by a federal judge at that time. All of this major news. After the indictment was unsealed here, the defense, of course, comes forward, and Eric Adams himself appearing in federal court just yesterday. That is a part of the process once again. He is entitled to be heard not only from the government about what the charges are. He's got a copy of this so-called talking indictment. It's big. Lots and lots of specific accounts of the ways in which he was acting, maybe not as an agent of Turkey, but acting in the interests of Turkish officials. All of that in this indictment, all of that presented to him officially in a proceeding on Friday morning. That's a part of the arraignment and plea process, the initial appearance. The judge is now requiring that he come back into federal court next week. The purpose of that is going to be to begin to figure out when this case will be tried. What are the evidentiary concerns? Is there evidence been produced to the defense as a part of this process already? All of that coming up, more of that coming up as we continue our second hour here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the Shaw, WAUK. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, Dan Davies and Craig Kinnett talk about their giant spider invasion event. And
the lovable producer Connor will give a full report after watching in person the green and gold take on the purple people eaters.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
October 12th and 13th is Waukesha Unlocked. The doors to more than 80 businesses, restaurants, and churches will be unlocked to highlight the city's architecture, history, and behind-the-scenes operations. Tour the city clean water plant or booster pumping station. On Saturday, Bill Quackenbush talks about the history of the Ho-Chunk Nation and the significance of the mounds at Cutler Park. Don't forget to turn in your trail challenge cards at City Hall to be put into a drawing for great prizes. Visit Waukesha Unlocked headquarters at City Hall between 10 and 4 on Saturday or Sunday for more information.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.